They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Welcome back, fans, listeners, and family, anyone who might be out there in the digital ether, to Magellan's at the Movies. I am Nathan Mogliines, as always, and also, as always, I'm joined by Elliot Mogliines. Elliot, you've got a couple of news items, new things that you wanted to discuss here in the banter section, so what are those?
Yes, sir. First up, we've got trailer for the next Predator movie. Still being helmed by... Well, now I've forgotten his name.
Dan Trachtenberg?
Yes.
Yeah, I can't pronounce
his
last name. Yes,
he is moving forward. There's a trailer out. Nathan, you haven't seen this trailer. So I'm just going to go ahead and spoil it for you, that it looks like the movie follows a predator rather than someone being hunted by a predator. Which, honestly, that really moved the needle for me. Like, I thought Prey was decent. I didn't love it to the same extent that a lot of people did. And I'm just not all that into the Predator franchise, but I would be down for that kind of flipping the script. Does that sound like something you'd be interested in, Nathan?
Definitely. I mean, I'm a big fan of this director because I think I've spoken on this podcast before about how much I enjoy 10 Cloverfield Lane, which was his first movie. I agree with you. I think Prey is maybe as good as the Predator formula can be. I'm not, like you, I'm not a huge fan of that formula, but if it is flipping that formula on its head or doing new things with that, I think that sounds really exciting. Yeah,
well, great, we're in agreement for once. Next up, we've got Andor season 2. It's all out, or it's started to come out.
First 3 episodes are out, I believe.
First 3 episodes. Okay. I have not seen this yet because I want to wait until the whole thing is out. Nathan has not watched this either, so it's kind of a struggle to talk about, but it's gotten very strong reviews. I think it's a similar story when it comes to audiences. A minority of whom, but a significant one, were turned off by the first season's slower pace and more thoughtful kind of approach and its quality, and just the plebs were not up for it. That's a joke. I'm kidding. So I think similar things are happening in this season, which doesn't bother me because Andor season 1 is probably the best thing that Disney Star Wars has put out. And this is the most excited I've been for a Star Wars product, I guess, ever. Or, well, I was excited for that, like, last season of Star Wars, The Clone Wars.
Yes.
We were big into that as children. Nathan, I know you are of a similar mind when it comes to Andor, so what you got for us in terms of season 2?
Yeah, I'm incredibly excited for it. I loved Andor season 1. I would probably agree with your assessment that Andor season 1 is the best Star Wars we've gotten from the Disney purchase. Some of the books that they've made have been pretty good, but I don't know if everyone's with it like that. But yeah, I'm very excited for to watch this new season. I am very hopeful that Andor doing well will maybe point Disney in a different direction. I still think that they need to do more standalone things, more low-stakes sort of things in the Star Wars universe, and they need to stop letting Dave Filoni stuff movies and shows with every Clone Wars character that he can conjure up miraculously from the dead. Because I think at Star Wars Celebration, they unveiled stuff about Ahsoka Season 2, and they're like, oh, Hayden Christensen is coming back as Anakin Skywalker. And I'm like, dude, that's like the fifth time. Like, it's not, that's not exciting to me. That is the least exciting thing in the world, to see a character that, in my opinion, everything interesting has already been mined from this character. Like, there's nothing more interesting you're gonna get out of Anakin and Ahsoka interacting than, like, their brief interaction in Star Wars Rebels, in my opinion. Like, that's the best you're probably gonna ever get. Certainly the most, like, I don't understand where else you can go from that.
Dude, that is almost the exact same reaction I had to learning about the Maul TV show.
Yeah, animated Maul. I was like,
dude, he's done, all right? That character has run its course at this point. We do not need more stuff about Darth Maul. It was cool when he showed up in Clone Wars. That was something, as a child. When I saw that, I was stupid. I was like, oh my gosh, he's still alive.
And I think it is honest, still cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that he was well handled in that show. He's definitely one of that show's best antagonists, but.
Oh, yeah.
We're good, okay? it's over. We don't need it. But, I mean, Disney doesn't care. They stopped taking my calls a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't mean to get into a bit of a sidetracked by Star Wars there, but I start talking about it. For the record, I am fairly excited for Sean Levy's Starfighter movie that he's making with Ryan Gosling. Again, because my hope is it will be smaller scale, more character focused, and just about people in what is still, for my money, like one of the best fictional universes in all of media. So
in the real universe.
Yeah. The universe that matters. Elliot, I think the only other big movie news is the subject of this week's podcast. Ryan Coogler's new movie, Sinners, had the largest original film box office weekend in the past decade. It edged out Jordan Peele's Nope by like $5 million. And current tracking for its second weekend shows that it might have an unprecedented, record-breaking 16% drop in revenue, which is that is an insane number. Typically, movies drop, if your movie is really good and has great word of mouth, usually it'll drop something from 30 to like 40%. If it's more than that, then it's kind of like a bad percentage drop. 16% is insane. I've never, it would be record breaking. But word of mouth on this film is incredibly strong. A lot of my buddies have seen it. Elliot, we've seen it. This is the subject of this episode. Let's maybe not dive in, but let's, you know, get our scuba gear and start heading out to sea here to talk about this movie.
Start squeezing into our wetsuits, get the old flippers on.
Yeah. So since this is a movie that is currently in theaters, this episode is going to have spoilers, but maybe let's just start with, should people, give your opening thoughts and answer the question, should people go and see this thing in theaters?
Well, first of all, I think that whatever else, literally whatever else we have to say about this movie, congratulations to the team. Well done to Warner Brothers for not messing it up.
Finally cobbling together a good movie and good ideas. Good job.
It's funny, I actually happened to learn recently, just today actually, that the, or at least one of the, like, leggiest movies in history, by leggiest meaning the movie that was in the theaters for longest, that suffered the least amount of decline in its box office, is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Interesting.
And it's actually an interesting parallel because it's an original movie and it's carried largely by really strong reviews and really strong word of mouth. So
yeah,
I can't think of a higher honor for a movie than to be placed alongside Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's so true.
But anyway, yeah. So opening thoughts. Now that I've said that, let me say what I think about the movie. For the first half of this movie, I was locked in. I was like, this is one of the best movies I've seen this year. This is one of the best movies that I've seen in a good long while. The build-up was perfect. The script just has so much energy, and there's just a music to every line of dialogue that it was just riveting. And everything was being set up so well. I loved the Southern Gothic style. I was digging the performances. There was just nothing about this movie's first half that I didn't like. And then, for the next quarter of the movie, there comes a point where the dynamics shift, naturally. And at that point, I think I was kind of, I was kind of at a nervous laugh stage, right? Where I was like, what are we doing here, guys? And then the last quarter of this movie. You know those moments in video games where you just make a silly mistake? And so, like, you heal at just the wrong time when you're fighting a boss, like, right as it is swinging at you. And there's just that split second where you know exactly what's went wrong and you kind of tensed up and you're like, oh, shoot, how much is this going to cost me? That was my experience of the last quarter of this movie, where I was just like, no, just stop. Let's stop here and limit the damage as much as we can. And yeah, that was the last quarter of this movie was me when I'm driving in a video game and like a high speed chase, and I accidentally drive like right into an obstacle, and I'm just like, oh shoot, but for like however many minutes. So what does that all add up to? Honestly, it's hard to say, because the first half is so good, and there is, throughout the whole movie, there's so much that's good about this movie, like the script and the performances and the cinematography, that I think, on balance, I would still say, yes, you should see this movie. See it to support original movies, see it for what's good about it, because I do think that it is enough to carry you through the experience, and see it because, in all likelihood, I'm just a very particular kind of person who's difficult to please, and you'll probably love this just as much as everyone else, and I'm in the minority, which I'm totally fine with. I accept and acknowledge that there's a good chance that the average person will enjoy this movie. For me, I think that there is so much about this movie that I like, so much of this movie that I love, but man, it ends on really, really shaky footing for me.
Interesting. I tried to not have anyone spoil your thoughts for me, but our mother did tell me that that was kind of how you felt about the movie. I'm probably more with the majority here on this. I would say I strongly recommend you go and see this movie in theaters. I think it is definitely a movie that benefits from being seen in theaters. I I think the soundtrack is incredible, and the way music is woven into the story of the film is something that does benefit from being in a theater and seeing these things with a really great sound system and on a really big screen. There's multiple moments where the movie almost becomes like a musical and is just like a visual and auditory feast for the senses. And that feast is best enjoyed in a theater, as well as I think this is a movie that people are going to be talking about. I think there's a lot of stuff in this movie that's really interesting that people are going to be discussing around the water cooler. If you work in a place that has a water cooler, my work does not have one of those, but maybe you do and you want to go up to the water cooler and engage in conversation with people. I think this is a movie that's going to have some staying power in terms of the film conversation moving forward. And I think the movie is also just really good. I'm really interested to talk about this movie with you because I feel like my experience was less. I think the highs were maybe a little lower for me, but I didn't experience any lows in the movie. There was no point in the movie where I was like, wow, that's really subpar, or I think that's a bad narrative decision, or I think that's stupid. And I think it was just a really consistently enjoyable and interesting and entertaining experience. So I think you should definitely go and see the movie. Yeah, that's what I think, without going into too many spoilers quite yet.
All right. Well, here ends the non-spoiler portion of the podcast. Yep. So just to wrap up, the Magellans at the Movies think that you should see this movie. You should see this movie in theaters. I mean, you should always see a movie and come to your own conclusions. But yeah, if you don't want it spoiled, we are going to start talking about spoilers. So from here on out, the whole movie is fair game.
Yep.
Nathan, you wanted to review this movie. So where do you want to start?
Well, I'd kind of like to start with the characters. This is a really interesting movie in terms of structure, because if you've seen the trailers, and, you know, I'll try to explain as much of the plot as possible if you're one of those people who doesn't mind spoilers and likes listening to other people talk about things you haven't seen. But it's kind of an interesting movie because if you've seen the trailers, they have obviously shown that there are vampires in the film, and the vampires don't show up until it's got to be like an hour and a half into the movie.
Until about that halfway mark.
So this movie spends a lot of time setting up the characters who are going to be put into a dangerous situation. The movie opens with kind of the end of, opens at its ending and then flashes back to the day prior. So it's already showed its hand that danger is coming for these principal characters, but it spends an hour and a half building up all of these characters, the most notable of which are Samuel, who is kind of our vessel, our vehicle. He is the son of a pastor. He works on a cotton plantation with his family, and his cousins, Smoke and Stack, played by Michael B. Jordan, not actually. Their real names are what?
Elijah and Elias.
Yeah, Elijah and Elias. But they are recently returned from Chicago. They're well-traveled. They're, you know, they know something about the outside world. He's gravitated to this. And they've come
back.
And
they're also, sorry, they're veterans of World War One.
Yes, yes. Yeah, they're also veterans of World War One. That's true, that's true. Which I think some people have been confused by the trailers as to what time period the movie takes place on. And it's not helped by the fact that some of the action does take place on a cotton plantation. Because I had a lot of people be like, I don't really want to watch another, you know, movie about slaves. And I'm like, nah, it takes place in the 1930s. Like,
yeah,
you're fine.
It's Prohibition era. Yeah. They're sharecroppers.
Yeah.
Not slaves. But, yeah. But I mean, you could obviously make an argument there.
They're not well off, but
they're not legal.
Smoke
slaves.
And Stack are back in town to set up a juke joint to bring the community together. So the movie, for the first hour and a half, follows Smoke and Stack as they're interacting with people from their past. This is their first time back in town, so they interact with Haley Steinfeld's Mary, who had a relationship with Smoke, I believe.
No, that would be Stack.
Gosh, dang it. I didn't take notes, okay? I was fully invested in the experience watching the movie. But she was previously
in a relationship. Well, obviously not if you can't remember these things.
Well, you know, I experienced the movie emotionally, not intellectually.
Ah.
But she was previously in a relationship with Stack. Smoke is also reuniting with his wife. Unclear if they're still married. The person that he had a child with, and then that child died. And they're also kind of getting people together, including a Asian American family, our mother and father.
They're Korean.
That's in Asia.
I know, I'm just saying specifically.
You just love to correct me.
Wow.
And then I think the only other kind of major character is, what's his name? Delroy Lindo's character.
Oh, man. See, that I don't
Something
remember.
Slim? Delta Slim? Tennessee Slim? A blues musician who they're bringing in to help play at the juke joint. But the movie opens with this section with these people. And Elliot, this I'm interested to hear some specifics of what you enjoyed, because this is the section that you most enjoyed. And this is, in my mind, this is kind of like if The Night of the Living Dead had an hour where you hung out with all the characters who were eventually trapped in the house. So, you know, what did you enjoy about this first half? And, you know, what did you like about these characters as you were learning things about them?
Well, I think mostly what I was loving was the promise, the potential that I could see in these characters and in this premise. I love a slow burner. I love the opening hour of Jurassic Park. I love every part of Blade Runner 2049. I like movies that take their time. I like foreshadowing and setup. I like getting to know about things before we, introductions of relationships and characters and mechanics and stuff before we start seeing those things in action. I just like to be well situated in a movie. And like I said, I cannot compliment enough this script, like the dialogue. It just crackles with energy, and it's partly the performances, partly the writing, but yeah, I wish I could quote them, but there's so much flipping swearing and
always our problem.
I know, but I just thought that, yeah, it's just musical. This dialogue, and yeah, I was just so into the setup. I could see so much potential in it that I was like, this is just so my thing. This is just so right up my alley. Because like I said, this Southern Gothic style, I love that. I thought the performances were great. I really like the way Smoke and Stack are introduced, because they're both played by Michael B. Jordan, which is becoming a thing these days, where actors will play two roles in a single movie. Alto Knights, anyone? Anyone seen that?
Yeah, that's Mickey 17, another movie no one's seen.
But yeah, I felt like they were just kind of flexing with this, because they're handing each other stuff and they're interacting, and I was like, I see you. You're trying to impress me, and I was impressed. I just thought that there were so many different ways the movie could go, and the foundations were so strong. Like, we were setting up conflict between Stack and Mary, potential conflict between Smoke and his, I guess, community towards the later end of this first half when they're arguing about essentially financial strategies. The setup is they're trying to set up a Duke joint for people, black people specifically, to just come and hang out and listen to music and have a good time. And Smoke doesn't want them to accept plantation money or non-American dollars. There's setup of conflict, or at least a relationship between Sam and this woman with a husband who I'm not 100% convinced exists because he never appears.
Got better things to do.
Yeah, he's, well, I guess he survives, so. I just thought that there was so much potential, and the script was incredible, and I really liked the introduction of the antagonist, this Irish vampire. I was like, I want to see where this is going. I want to be impressed. I've been impressed so far, and I want to continue to be impressed. I can't wait for the release, right? Like this buildup of tension. This is the disappointing dinosaur tour. Now let's have the T-Rex breakout scene. And then we'll talk about what happens later.
Well, I would just agree with everything you said there. I think the opening hour is so fantastic at setting a specific tone for the movie, establishing a place for the film. Like we said, it takes place in a very interesting sort of period. Again, it's kind of confused. I feel like every time I see things about America in the 1930s, I'm like, oh, we didn't like modernize very quickly. Like it took, kind of like Killers of the Flower Moon, right? Where it takes place in a time period that in my head, I'm like, yeah, we've got like cars and stuff, so we're fairly modern. And then I watch stuff and I'm like, oh, we're like 2 years removed from Red Dead Redemption or something of that sort. And so it does such a great job of establishing this, the time period. And then, yeah, like you said, it establishes the characters with a lot of really compelling hooks, right? We have Stack and Mary, and there's clearly a lot of emotion there, and Smoke and Annie, his significant other, the woman, I don't know what to... Annie, his Annie, and I think especially Samuel. Samuel is a very interesting character because he's, again, very young, very naive. He's kind of just having a great time soaking up all of the knowledge that his cousins have. That because Smoke and Stack have been right in World War One, so they were in Europe, and then they've been in Chicago. They've done all these cool, exciting things, and so they're telling him about stuff, and he loves hearing about it, right? He loves learning, and when they add Delta Slim, which is Delroy Lindo's character, he, right, enjoys listening to him. And also, just an incredible performance from, I'm pretty sure at the end of the movie it said introducing Miles Caton? I can't pronounce names. And so if this is his first movie, like, amazing job, incredible job. He really hit the ground running here. But yeah, all of the performances are really fantastic. I was especially impressed with how quickly the movie established the differences between Smoke and Stack, and just the different ways that they are looking at things. That clearly Stack is a little more emotional, a little more given to the extremes of things, and Smoke is very much focused on business. That he's like, we've got to get these things done, we've got to do this stuff, we've got to get this plan in motion. Which I think is really good, because when they showed up in that first scene, I was like, oh gosh, I'm gonna have a really tough time telling these characters apart. And then it was really fast that I was able to really easily tell them apart. Not just because they were dressed a little differently, but also because they were distinct people, and they were written distinctly, which I think is sounds like something very simple, but so many people do this poorly, so it was really fun to see it done. Wow. So I think this first hour just does an amazing job of setting up all of these moving pieces. And now, this is where we get to the interesting stuff, because this is where I think maybe we'll diverge a little bit. Because, right, we hit nighttime, and if you've seen the movie, I don't have to tell you that the sequence where Samuel plays the blues, and then there's a big long oner where music from all different sort of time periods starts appearing. He's summoning it in, I guess the premise is that his music is so powerful that it kind of tears apart time, or like bends time such that all the great musicians start showing up in the same place to share in the community of music. It's an incredible sequence. Again, it's something that really does deserve to be seen on a big screen and with a great sound system, because it's sick. But then...
I actually kind of thought that was a little goofy.
I guess it... See, and maybe this is where we could start to discuss things, because the movie is goofy. And I think that's a good thing. I find that fascinating, that the movie is goofy. Like I said in my opening thoughts, there's points where the movie almost becomes a musical. Obviously, in this sequence where Samuel is playing, it's only music and camera. But then later in the film, after the villain vampire has turned most of the party, there's another sequence where there's an extended Irish jig with all of the vampires. And yeah, I guess to me, the goofiness was like a good thing. I like seeing movies where I didn't feel like it broke the tension of anything, because I felt like the musical sequence with Sam worked because like the movie had been building to this, talking about Samuel kind of feeling torn between his father, who is, as a pastor, represents kind of tradition and conservative sort of values, and, right, his cousins, who are exciting and new and represent, right, the rest of the world. And so I felt like that musical sequence made sense. And then the musical sequence with the Irish jig was just the perfect combination of, like, weird and creepy. And I felt like it didn't feel like it destroyed the tension of what was happening for me, because it was just so weird that I was still tense, but it was weird in a way that and I think this is one of the things that's maybe most exciting about this movie to me, that the movie is so clearly the work of individual artists creating something. It's not the, like, the Minecraft movie is such a big thing. The Minecraft, I haven't watched it, so my criticism, I guess I'll criticize the Super Mario Brothers movie, which I would imagine is a very similar thing. That does not feel like a movie that's made by an individual artist with a clear artistic vision or an individual sort of perspective. It feels like a movie made by a boardroom of people in suits trying to figure out what people like. And I love that Sinners feels like a movie that is just so weird only a person could have done it, or only a person could have, you know, thought of this. And so for me, the goofiness of the film in this back half, I see as like a positive feature of the film.
Well,
explain to me how you hate artists, Elliot.
Well, I have no problem with artists. It's fine to have a vision, but there's a substantial difference between imagining a triple axel and actually doing one, executing one.
Oh, you sure?
Like, if a gymnast, isn't that an ice skating thing?
An axel would be an ice skating thing, yes.
Yeah, so if an ice skater came up to me and said, like, oh, I'm gonna do a triple axel, I'd be like, hey, great. But I wouldn't be like, wow, that's amazing, because they haven't done it yet. No, I don't. My problem is not with the goofiness of the movie. I wouldn't even describe it as that goofy, frankly. Mm. I liked the Irish jig, okay, I guess, if only because I felt like that was a good character moment of demonstrating the like sadistic pleasure that this vampire took in what's his name?
Remick? Something like that? Remick.
Remick. That Remick took in his domination of his people. I just thought that the music, Sam's music thing was just kind of silly because it just looked silly to have all of these different people doing different things here. And I also felt like the thread of music specifically being this kind of like transcendental unifying force is kind of dropped from that point on. Mm. It provides a narrative impulse for Remick to honestly, this is a little weird as well. Remick wants Sammy, I guess, so that Sammy can play him music. And the music, what, like, makes him feel things? Or
something like that. That's my sense of what his plan was. That he could communicate with people and an emotion that he had lost, being a vampire and having lived for presumably centuries.
Okay, well, I would have liked to have seen that emphasized more. Because as it is right now, I think it's a little vague, his motivation. No, my problem, the nervous laugh sector of this movie is, I can pinpoint exactly where it starts, where Smoke, Stack is killed by Mary.
Yeah.
Or he's, turned. He has his blood drained. And so Smoke then shoots Mary. That doesn't work because she's a vampire. So she stands up and then she runs out. She runs out of the building. And I remember very distinctly sitting in the theater and being like, huh, where is she going? Why is she leaving when she should know that she will not be able to get back in short of an invitation? So I was like, that's weird. That's a little sloppy. And then the exact same thing happens to Stack. Stack is turned into a vampire. And I guess it's a little bit better because he gets wounded with something that actually poses a threat to him. But again, he runs out of the building. And I was like, why are they leaving the building? They can't get back in unless someone invites them. And so then I was like, then again, I'm like, at this point, I'm still on the movie side. So I was like, oh, well, I guess it's going to kind of turn into a sort of panic room situation where there's going to be some like push and pull between the people in the juke joint trying to rebuff the vampire's attempts to get into the building. So I was like, oh, well, that's cool. That's a good way to generate tension. But that doesn't happen. There is no tension in this segment of the movie because the vampires don't try anything to get into the joint. And it seems like, for all intents and purposes, our hero's intention is to just wait it out. And I was like, well, that's lame. Because I was like, so where is the tension coming from here? Because they can just not leave. And the idea is floated that because the Korean woman's husband gets turned. And so the idea is floated that the vampires could go and see their daughter. And I was like, oh, here we go. Bam, right here. Tension. No one brings that idea up ever again. Because, again, I was like, oh, this is how we're going to have to get back into the into action mode. By which I don't mean fighting, but like characters making action, having agency, making decisions. Because they're going to have to figure out some way to stop that. That doesn't happen. This whole segment of the movie is just exposition about the vampires and having heated arguments with the vampires standing outside of the door and the Irish jig. And I was like, whoa, man, this is weird. Why are we not, like, doing things with this premise? Why are we just kind of... why have we shifted into neutral? And I don't know, do you want me to keep going into the into when it really starts to get off the rails for me?
I mean, sure. You know, you can talk for as long as you want, Elliot. That's the nature of the podcast.
Well, I know, but I feel like sometimes it's better if we break it up. But it's fine. I'll keep going. So that's not great. But then eventually the Korean woman, I forgot her name. Gosh dang it. Let's find it.
Lee?
I think that's their, like, surname.
Dang it.
Wikipedia, you're not helping.
Lisa.
Oh, so you were close.
Thank you.
Lisa eventually... Oh,
Grace, actually. Lisa's their daughter. Grace is the name of the woman.
Grace. So Grace eventually invites the vampires in.
Yeah.
I can't quite remember why.
Well, see, this
she
is
just
where...
gets overwhelmed?
No, this is where I'm confused by you saying their daughter being threatened never comes up again. That's why she calls them in, is because she's afraid they're going to leave. And so, in her mind,
yeah,
the only ploy is to, like, goad them into coming and then killing them.
But they don't leave. There's, like, 15 whole minutes in between... when they say, we'll just go kill Lisa, or turn Lisa, and it seems like, in the movie, it seems like Grace is neutralized. Like, they convince her to not. And I was like, well, that makes sense, because the vampires aren't moving. Like, the vampires are not pressing this advantage that they have. Which is why I was so baffled. I was like... This should be an urgent, immediate problem that causes immediate knock-on effects, but it just isn't. The vampires just stand around doing nothing. So anyway, eventually Grace gets overwhelmed and she invites them in. And so then there's a big brawl. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's... fine, I guess. Like, it's not what I was hoping for, because that's fairly simple, because they're just fighting. But it's a good fight. Smoke, he's a man. He is good at fighting. they stab hearts with the absolute greatest of ease, which, I mean, it's not a big deal. Like, it's just one of those things that you have to. It's something that you kind of have to do. I do feel like the writers wrote themselves into a corner and didn't really have any idea how to get out of it. So then the thing that was keeping me most in the movie was the looming decision that Smoke was going to have to make about Stack. Because they're brothers, and I was like, oh, this is very affecting. This is brutal, and I like it. And I should also say that Annie makes very clear that Remick has no control, no supernatural control over the people he has turned. Am I right about that?
Annie doesn't make it clear. The vampires purport that Remick is not controlling them. When the vampires...
No, someone says that even if you kill Remick, that's not going to have any effect
on
his... his minions.
She says that, but she doesn't mean it as like they're a hive mind. She just means it as like, if you kill Remick, you won't turn everyone back to human.
Okay, so what is the nature of Remick's relationship to his people?
It's unclear. Because the only information
we're given...
I don't
like that.
Well, you know, I'm sorry the vampire didn't... You know, this is always where... in my mind, this is the least interesting form of film criticism. Where, you know, I don't want to get us into a argument where I'm like, well, you know, what would you want? The vampires to explain in minute detail the nature of their, like, mythology and stuff? Because I already feel
I want
like
the writers to have a plan. I want them to have a vision. And like we said with Clue, this impacts the stakes of the movie. We need to know whether or not defeating Remick means defeating the vampires, because short of that, it is unclear what our protagonist's goals are or should be. So anyway, that's unclear. I think that's bad. That maybe that's just me. I don't like that. I won't say that's bad. I don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so people start dying, and mostly it's people that I'm not that invested in. Like, Sammy's girl person dies, and I was like, why is she still in this movie? Smokes, Annie dies, Grace dies, Delta Slim dies, all of which I'm like, okay, so the movie's in apocalypse mode, right? Everyone, it's in that moment in Rogue One when you're like, oh, okay, so most of these people are just
gonna
die.
Yeah. Spoilers
then,
for Rogue One.
Sammy gets away briefly, and Remick goes after him, and they're in a river. And for a second, I thought, oh my gosh, if Sammy defeats Remick by blessing the river and turning it all into holy water, I was like, that's gonna be awesome. That's cool, and that's a smart way to defeat him. But no, he gets defeated because Smoke stabs him in the back.
Nice.
Smoke has walked up to Remick, and I should mention that all of the other vampires are present. So they're just watching Smoke, and they're like, oh, wonder what that guy's doing. So they just wait until... that's not what happens, obviously. I'm just saying that it is not shown his approach, because his approach is impossible. It is not possible. He is in full view of Remick's minions, and they should not be just standing around like, what is Smoke doing? Why has he got that stake on him? That's weird. So he stabs Remick in the back, and I was like, come on. That is so lame. And before that, Sammy hits Remick in the head, and all of the vampires react.
Yeah, so, see, this is where I would say the movie does seem to imply that Remick was lying previously, and that he isn't able to exert some sort of control over the people he has turned. Which makes some sense, because, like, the Ku Klux Klan members that he turns at the beginning do not have any musical ability. Like, there's no way they'd be able to do the little Irish song and dance things that the characters do when they appear. So I would say that implies that Remick was lying, firstly, and then secondly, the way, at least in my head, the way Smoke was able to sneak up on them was because Remick was wholly concentrated on Samuel and he wasn't letting any of the other people pay attention.
You're doing the movie's work for it, Nathan.
Well, see, and this is, you know, maybe this is where I can give...
Well,
I guess if you
I'm
have
not done
more...
Because I considered that cannot be true, or that should not be true, because Stack tells Mary to leave. That should not be possible if Remick is controlling them and she is under orders to keep on attacking. And then, this is probably my least favorite choice that the movie makes, bar none. Smoke does not kill Stack. It's implied that he does, but it's revealed that he doesn't. Because they have this end credit scene where Sammy grows up, or it's not end credits, it's like during the credits.
Yeah.
Sammy grows up and he becomes a musician, and then Stack and Mary come in. And Stack says, "Smoke made me promise to leave you alone." That cannot be a promise that he could make at that moment if he was under Remick's control. And also, that is just so... Remember in Scream 6 when Mason Gooding Jr.'s character, what's his name?
I don't know. When he gets stabbed 8 gajillion times.
Yeah, he gets stabbed 8 gajillion times. And I think we talked about this in the review. Yeah. It's revealed that he's alive. And I was like, oh, that's really disappointing because that was a really affecting, moving part of the movie. Like, that got me to feel things and to get more invested in what was happening. And the movie didn't have the guts to go through with it. And I would say the exact same thing happens here. I was so... I just, like, the air just went out of me when Stack walked through the doors. Not initially, because I was like, wait a second, what is going on with Remick and his control over the vampires? But just that immediate gut reaction of, I was like, oh, that feeling that I was feeling, that was a lie. The movie didn't do that cool, strong, affecting thing that I thought it did, and it played it safe, and I was sad. And then I left the theater.
Well, that's unfortunate. I guess I don't want this episode to get bloated to way over, but I feel like this is interesting to me because my brain was just in a completely different place from where it seems your brain was watching this back section of the movie. Because in my mind, the beginning of this movie introduced so many ideas that I found very interesting in terms of Smoke and Stack and Samuel and their relationship to their community and their relationship to their history and where that history is sort of moving them moving forward in life, right? That they're and there's discussions where the characters are talking about Samuel and the destiny and like the choices that he's making and where he should go. I think Smoke tells Samuel about him and Stack trying to go to this town where it's like only populated with black people and it's like a utopia and it's so great. And he's like, we were kicked out because our dad was a bad person. And so they believed that sin was, right, kind of carried along. And so they didn't let us join their community. But like, you can, right? Your dad's a pastor. They would accept you. They'd take you in. And so I feel like where you were thinking, or at least it sounds like you were looking at the movie as more of like a horror movie where you're like, or like Jurassic Park, right? We're building up all these things. And so now we're getting to the part where tension is introduced. For me, I was like, okay, we're introducing all these questions about community and identity and the choices we've made in the past impacting what choices we're going to make moving forward in the future. And so that was the thing that I was most keyed into and interested in the movie exploring and answering questions to as we entered into the section with the vampires. And I found it really enjoyable because I feel like the introduction of the vampires is interesting because of the ambiguity of what the vampires represent. Because this movie takes a very like original Bram Stoker sort of looking at the vampires. That in the original Dracula book, they talk a fair amount that the worst part about being a vampire is the fact that your soul can never leave the earth. And so you're trapped in the state that you were in as a vampire. And so more than once, they make the point that they're like, even if a person is ostensibly happy as a vampire, they can't be because they've trapped themselves in a place that they can't grow or change or fix themselves in. And so this movie does the same thing that Annie says, that she's like, even if, right, Remick is not controlling them, even if they have some amount of free will, that's irrelevant because they can never die and go to heaven, is basically like the crux of what she says. And I think I found that to be very compelling because it added into what I see as a very interesting sort of discussion of keeping your own identity in a place where your identity has to be assimilated. Like, all of the characters in the movie are represented as immigrants or not what we would traditionally think of as, like, right, they were not, you know, the pilgrims, right? The villain Remick.
The pilgrims were immigrants.
Whatever, okay. You get what I'm saying, like, you get what I'm saying, though, right? That all of the characters are
outsiders.
Outsiders, outsiders in some sense. And so this question of how do you stay you if you have to lose part of what makes you unique in order to fit in with everyone else, in order to be assimilated. And the vampires, right, represents kind of a horror story version of that, that everyone is having to do an Irish jig with Remick because none of them have any of their own individuality anymore. And it's something that I found very compelling that the movie, and I think it's something that's simultaneously frustrating and interesting to me, that the movie doesn't ever really make a super strong case against being turned into a vampire. Like, besides the fact that it seems as though you'll be under mind control by some Irish guy, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of cons. And especially in that mid-credit scene, right, that Stack and Mary show up, and it's like, okay, they're fine. Like, they're just chilling, so why did we not want to become vampires? And I like the fact that the movie maybe doesn't make a super strong case because it asks you to engage with the film in some sense. Because I think Smoke's ending becomes kind of poignant, and the end credit scene, too, does make somewhat of a case that Smoke ends up dying in a shootout with the Ku Klux Klan, and then he has kind of a vision of seeing Annie and seeing his daughter again. And so there's an implication that he's gotten a happy ending because he was able to cleanse his soul of whatever guilt he was feeling, and he's able to see the people that he loves again. Whereas in the end credit scene, Stack asserts that the happiest day of his life was the day depicted in this movie because it was the last time he saw his brother, and it was the last time that he felt the sun, and it was the, right, all of these things that the traditional romantic sense of what's bad about being a vampire states, that it's bad because you can't change or grow or do anything. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that Stack and Mary are together when they were both human, Stack asserted that they could never be together. And so, to me, that's interesting, even if I can't fully bring into words what the movie is saying with that, I think it's something interesting that I keep thinking about. And so it sounds like we were in kind of different places, that I was looking at thematic sort of material at this section where I don't disagree with you. All of those things are 100% true. Why did Mary and Stack run out of the house if they knew they were going to have to work to get back into it? Especially if Remick's goal was to get into the house, seems like leaving someone in there to kill everyone except Samuel would be like the obvious thing that he should do. But that never even crossed my mind when I was watching the movie because I was thinking of different questions and interacting with the movie in a different sort of way.
Well, I don't care about that. I'm going to take it one further. I cannot care about thematic material if the formal material is not working. Because if all the story has is these ideas, these arguments, I would frankly rather just read about them in a philosophy textbook rather than to have them kind of sloppily inserted into an unstable, possibly poorly thought out formal framework. Like, to me, and I honestly don't want to sound too strident here, because I do recognize that this is that this is personal to, I'm just gonna ignore you, Nathan, that this is personal to me. To me, that stuff, that's secondary stuff, or not secondary, but that's like, you can't spend money before you earned it. Like, you have to set that up. That has to work within the context of the story. Otherwise, why should I care about any of it? Like, why should I care about that if that same level of thought and care has not gone into every part of it? Then I'm going to say that's just kind of lazy. Or, like, then you really should just be writing essays in the New York Times rather than making movies.
Well, and I think, you know, this is not to say that the only thing that I thought was good about the back half of the movie was the things that I found interesting in the movie. I think the movie is better constructed in this back half than you're giving it credit for. I think the sequence where Mary goes out to talk to the vampires and try and gauge kind of their deal, that's an incredible sequence. All of the vampires have like glow in the dark eyes.
They're like the replicants in Blade.
Yeah. But in this whole sequence, all of the vampires, their eyes are like in shadow, which had to have been a nightmare to get the lighting right for, but it was so sick. And I think I genuinely, I don't know if I gasped, but I definitely made a bit of like a noise when Mary walks away and Remick starts flying behind her just for half a second.
That's another thing. Remick can fly, apparently.
Yeah,
sick. He never really makes use of that.
Well, the budget, they didn't really have the budget to do it very much.
Then it shouldn't be in the movie at all.
I don't think it really matters. Like, there's not that many times where dang, he should be flying right now.
Like, he should grab Sammy and just float in the air so no one can sneak up on him.
I mean, that wouldn't have been a bad idea, but he, you know, he had a thing in his head. Anyway.
I am not at my best when I have a big plate of metal in my head.
But I thought that was a really great scene. And then every time a character gets turned into a vampire, I loved this movie's use of like the traditional vampire like rules, because then they have to be invited back in. So when Mary comes back and has to be asked to let back in, I was like, she's a vampire, bro. Don't let her back in. She's evil. Don't be fooling around with this. And same with the extended section where Cornbread is trying to get back into the thing and Annie is savvy enough to not let him back in. Also, this had me in absolute pieces, because the entire section that they're making this big deal about people being invited in, I was like, Flip, bro, when Samuel is in the church at the beginning, the pastor definitely invites him in to the church. And I was like, dude, he's a vampire at the end of the movie. What the heck? That's so awful. And then it turned out to be a red herring, because he is invited in, but he's not a vampire at the end of the film. But I think,
well,
the movie is...
maybe he is. No, he's not.
No, he's not.
Age.
He ages. Yeah. What are you talking about, bro? Over here doing a film theory on me. But I think it's really well done. And I agree, it's not like the most immaculately constructed exercise in tension building. Like, this is not the thing. In fact, the scene where they're doing a bit of classic The Thing-ism, where they're trying to make everyone eat garlic to prove they're not a vampire, this scene kind of fell completely flat for me, because I was like, none of these characters are vampires. And they try to trick you into thinking one of them is, because she's hesitant to just eat raw garlic because anyone
would rather get shot.
Yeah, she's way too against it. But also, I was like, she has not, like, left the camera lens this whole... Like, there's no way she's a vampire. So that scene, you know, I agree. The movie is not immaculately constructed to create tension. But I think it's still doing a really good job of teasing out different ideas through the things the characters are being forced to confront. That the vampire has a really straight up conversation with the characters trying to goad them into coming out, which then triggers, right, Grace to do what she ends up doing. And yeah, I think, you know, the movie isn't like immaculately, again, it's not like The Thing or The Shining levels of, wow, you are just perfectly constructing a horror movie set piece here, but it's doing a really good job. Like, it's doing way better than a lot of other horror movies I've seen. And I found this whole section to be really interesting and very engaging. Outside of that one scene with the garlic. That was kind of... I was kind of like, all right, bro.
I would have to disagree with the idea that... I don't think if they had posed the notion of going after Grace's child and then actually did that, I would not call that immaculate. I would call that basic. Mm. I would call that fundamentals. So, it's just all of this stuff. I agree that it looks cool. I agree. I mean, I agree that the scene with Mary and the vampires, I like that scene a lot. But I cannot express how meaningless cool images are to me. Yeah. Like, I do not care. If it's cool, I would just... If you're just interested in making cool images, paint a painting, dude. Or, right, like, have ChatGPT generate something for you. This is a story. This is a narrative with characters and an internal logic that has to be consistent, because if it's not, then the stakes are threatened, the investment is threatened, the characters cannot function. To me, they cannot function, and all of this stuff can make no impression upon me if it's all just, right, like, if it's all soulless, if it has no basis, no strong foundation.
Are you still not trying to be strident? You called this sloppily constructed and soulless.
I don't know what else to say. Like,
no, that's someone, it's fair, if, Elliot. If that's someone, so fair.
Right, like, pounds a nail into a board at the wrong place, there's no other word for that than sloppy.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, this is, we always say this on the podcast. Like, the only way you can review the movie is the way you can. And I'm assuming that you feel the same way I do in this section, where I'm like, did you watch a different, like, what is your deal? Why are you looking at it this way? That's such a goofy way of looking at it. Look at it the way I am, the correct and objective best way to watch the movie.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, we feel differently about the back half of the... In a huge shock. Although, I do think if I've learned anything from what you enjoy about movies in this podcast, I do think your assertion that you don't care about cool images is one of the biggest things, which is interesting to me, because I agree with you in some sense. I think I've said on this podcast before that my favorite types of movies are the ones where the thematic elements are perfectly married to the actual story that you're seeing, that what the director is trying to get the audience to feel or think about is what the character is thinking about or feeling. And I would not say that this movie is like a perfect version of that, because again, Samuel, like, it leaves a fair amount ambiguous in a way that I can't really tell is intentional and trying to, like, guide me towards thinking about something more deeply in a way that, like, 2001 is kind of ambiguous in a way that it's trying to make you think about stuff. But I do think, for the most part, the movie is accomplishing, for me, its task of getting me to feel very invested, feel emotional as the characters go through things, and think about, at least from the interviews I've read, the same things that Ryan Coogler was thinking about when he was writing the script and the actors were thinking about as they were performing in the film. So it's a success for me. I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, like, that, I understand the impulse to skip the appetizers, skip the salad, and get right to dessert, but that is superficial. That is shallow, and that is not...
Are you calling me superficial and shallow?
That is not a complete meal. That is not a good meal. You gotta...
How dare you?
You gotta start with the meat and potatoes and the vegetables, and then you can do all that stuff.
Meat and potatoes is your... What? What kind of meal are you constructing
again,
here?
I'm just going to keep on ignoring Nathan. I cannot bring myself to care about that. I don't know. I've run out of ways to say, no, like, the movie is cashing a check that it has not earned.
No, that's fair. That's fair enough. Then I say we should get to ratings if you don't have close. I have a couple of closing thoughts, but I'll drop them right before my ratings here.
Well, I just want to say that this movie is a looker. Great lighting, great cinematography, great special effects. It's a bit of an expensive movie, I've heard.
Yeah, from that one Variety hit piece.
What?
But did you not see this? That Variety had an article where they're like, Sinners did great, but is it good enough? Where they were kind of like underselling how big of a deal this movie's like box office success is. Where they're like, well, it doesn't really matter because this and this and this. Anyway, whatever. You keep going.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't read Variety, for the record.
I don't either. I read the article.
I read in a New York Times article.
Wow.
That just said that the movie was expensive, or that it cost a certain amount.
It cost a fair amount. It was cheap.
Well, I would say that it looks it. And it's unfortunate. I always feel bad about these kinds of movies. A, because for literally all appearances being to the contrary, I don't actually like disliking things. And I don't like complaining about movies. I am forced into it, I feel. But then it takes up so... I have to spend so much time explaining what doesn't work about the movie that what does work about it is lost, because let me just remind everyone that I think you should see this movie. I think this movie is worth seeing. It's worth seeing in theaters, not just for supporting original movies, which we here at Magellan's at the Movies are 100% behind.
Yeah.
But for its quality, for the qualities that it has, which are not negligible. They are substantial. I almost said Ryan Coogler. Michael B. Jordan is the actor. Great performance. It must be really hard to differentiate yourself and to also have to act opposite yourself. Great job. Great job, everyone. Delroy Lindo, the man with the unpronounceable last name, plays Sammy, the vampire. All of these guys are doing great. And again, like, the script is so sharp. Even when the plot is failing, I still enjoyed this movie for the dialogue, because it's just enjoyable to listen to. It's just pleasing, like, phonetically. I enjoyed the last fight. I just love that opening bit, the first half of the movie. But the opening half of the movie, like the movie itself, is writing a check that it's not able to cash in the ultimate, in the aggregate. But I think that this movie, I think this movie is worth seeing. It's a tragedy. It's a tragic movie because I wanted so badly to love it. And I did love it for so long, and I wanted it, I was willing it to pull through. And even in that shaky moment before it undercuts itself at the very end with the reveal of Stack, I was like, please, 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 just end. I that's what I was saying when I was like, stop, stop. Because I was like, just end so I can like you. But yeah, it's really difficult, but I'm going to have to give this movie a C+.
Wow. It's better than I thought you were going to give it.
Really? Well, see, that disappoints me because it does show that I've spent too much time and probably been too strident in explaining the things that don't work about the movie. But what? Yeah, I mean, like it's so hard to explain because I'm not saying that the movie's mediocre, right? It's more like if you imagine, I don't know, a battle between these two massive armies representing what's good about the movie and what's bad about the movie. It's such a pitched fight because there's so much that I don't like and so much that I do like that in the offing, what I do like just barely scratches out a victory. Does that make any sense? I'm just talking complete nonsense at this point.
No, I get it. I get it. I have movies like that where I'm like, it's tough for me to grade this because at your height, you're like a 10 out of 10 movie, but at your lowest, you're like a 4 out of 10. And
yes,
so
exactly.
Most movies, I think, have a very consistent quality for me, at least. And so when the movie has wildly varying qualities, that's when it gets a lot harder to review it, I feel like. And also, we've talked about how, as a reviewer, it's hard to, because you want to use like interesting and evocative sort of words to describe your opinions, because you don't just want to say like, yeah, it's kind of mediocre, because that's not very descriptive or helpful. But the only words you can use are words that might be more extreme than your emotions call for. And so you're trying to clearly explain what you find subpar about this movie in the back half, and your only option is to use some words that maybe are a little harsher than your true feelings, because the English language is not fit for the emotions of the human person. Anyway, my closing thoughts here is I did want to say, I think the soundtrack to this movie is so sick. I've been listening to it casually. I think,
whoa, that does not happen often.
I know. Well, all of the songs that are sung in this movie, I think, are really fun. And just the way the music develops through the film, it gives it so much energy and excitement, and it's a lot of sick guitar-heavy blues sort of stuff. And it was just, there were so many scenes where it was just like people driving in a car, and then the music kicked in, and I was like, dude, why did you go this hard for the scene of them driving? Like, this track
is the best driving scene I've ever seen.
Yeah, this is sick. So great. And again, fantastic, because the movie is about partially music and musical heritage. And so the fact that the music tells as much of a story, in my opinion, as the movie in some places, I think is really sick. The music that's playing when they do the whole Generations Oneer thing is a really sweet, like the way all of the different pieces and eras and genres come in is really cool. Also, my favorite acting moment of the movie is when Stack shoots the guy who has, like, he's kind of messing with Stack's car, and so Stack has to shoot him to kind of show he's serious.
I'm sure that's Smoke.
Ah, gosh, dang it. Smoke has to shoot him. It's a great scene, because you can see in Michael B. Jordan's face as he's doing it that there's an emotion of, like, ah, gosh, dang it. Like, he really does want to do good and, like, do right by the community, but he's also, right, he's trying to impress upon them a certain persona of thing, and so he has to shoot these guys, and it's just a really great, like, the perfect amount of subtle, to where it's not so subtle that you could argue it's not there, but it's not so overt that it's like they're playing to the rafters. It's a really great little acting moment. And yeah, I would echo the other things that you said on a technical level. The movie looks fantastic. So many great lit scenes. I feel like I've been seeing some people discuss, you know, movies set during the night sometimes having, you know, not enough light for you to see anything. This movie does such a great job with shadows and with all of this other stuff. It looks fantastic. Like every time that we review a movie that Elliot is more critical towards than I am, I feel like it sounds like I'm over the moon about this movie. I haven't been able to talk about what I dislike about the movie.
We're really exposing the fragility of the pointlessness of this whole endeavor.
But like I said, there's some moments in the back half where the tension, it does feel like the movie is trying to be more tense than it is able to obtain. There's some points in the back half that feel more ambiguous than they should be, or at least more ambiguous than I would like them to be. I would kind of agree with you that the mid-credit scene, I saw it a week ago. I'm still not entirely sure how I feel about the mid-credit scene, because I agree, it feels like a bit of a cop-out. Like, why were they even fighting the vampires if they could have all been sick, like, wearing cool clothes in the 90s? And still be young. Like, if they could have all done that, why were they fighting the vampires? Seems like that's a good, attainable goal. But on the whole, this movie, it's such a ride. It's so much fun. It is such a, like, such an original film while still being such a fun throwback to so many different movies and so many different influences. It's such a fun movie to see. I had a fantastic time in the theaters, so all of these negatives, I think the movie is greater than those things for me as well. It's not like a masterpiece, but I'm giving this movie an 8 out of 10.
Not too shabby at all. I just want to say for not longtime listeners, what an endorsement it is for Nathan to listen to a movie soundtrack casually, because that just does not happen. Yeah. Or I listen to movie soundtracks a lot more than Nathan does.
Yeah.
So
very few. I don't think we've reviewed a movie yet where I've been like, yeah, I listened to this casually.
Dang. Not even like,
I mean, Interstellar.
Tron Legacy?
Yeah, Tron Legacy. Those are maybe the two. Anyway, Elliot, you didn't love this movie.
Wait. Your one more thing. Did you stay for the after credit scene?
Where he's singing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this
I did.
This little light of mine.
I thought it was neat.
What's that about?
I don't know. They just had it, and they were like, heck, throw it in there, bro. Ryan Coogler made too many Marvel movies, and now he doesn't know you can make movies without post-credit scenes.
That's it. He's like, now I'm contractually obliged to have a post-credit scene here, right? And his producer's like, what? What are you talking about?
Anyway, Elliot, what is your recommendation for this film?
Well, I have got a very rare two recommendations.
What on earth?
Where I couldn't decide. I had two recommendations, both leveraging two very different things that this movie also does well. So, for my vampire movie loving brethren, I see you, I understand you, I am not one of you, but I empathize with you, and I have two vampire movies for you to watch based on different aspects of Sinners. If you like Sinners for the slick, cool, modern, kind of like iterating on vampires and classic vampire lore, I'm going to point you in the direction of Abigail. This is a movie directed by Radio Silence, directors of the Scream reboots before they went off the rails. And I would say that Scream is probably the best point of reference for this movie, that it's really more of a horror comedy, right? Like, Scream, it's funnier than it is scary, right? Or at least I think that. And the same thing is said of this movie. It's not really there to give you the chills, to make you scared, to go home by yourself. it's there to be fun, it's there to be funny, and it's there to have these really, well, just like these cool little iterations, variations on vampires and vampire lore. If, however, you liked Sinners more for its construction, right, and like me, we're a little, we're disappointed with the ways that the construction kind of floundered at the end, I'm pointing you in the direction of Nosferatu, the 2024 movie. I've already talked about this movie at length. I've already recommended it for Alien. But this is, for my money, the best vampire movie out there, and its construction is immaculate. This is a very tightly plotted movie. It also has that heavy stylization, albeit a very different kind of stylization, because this is obviously much more Gothic, right? Germanic Gothic rather than Southern Gothic. But it has that... This is a movie for the people who want scares, right? This is a movie for chills. And also just for people who like things that are cool and good. So yeah, those are my two recommendations. You're welcome.
Wow. Really a glut of vampire recommendations here, because my movie is also going to be a vampire movie. I would say I haven't seen Abigail.
Let the right one in?
Huh?
Let the right one in?
Oh, that's a terrible guess.
Sorry.
I don't like that movie at all.
I don't either.
Yeah, Nosferatu is pretty good. I'm not as over the moon about it as Elliot is. But my recommendation is what I think is maybe the most... Again, I really appreciated about this movie its commitment to an idea I find very compelling, that the worst part about being a vampire is kind of being a lost soul and not, like, being able to fix that fact about yourself. So I'm going to go with the other vampire movie that I think I have seen this most powerfully represented in, and that's going to be Francis Ford Coppola's adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula. This is maybe most famous for Keanu Reeves' truly, truly horrendous British accent. I mean, one of the worst casting decisions of all time to cast him as Jonathan Harkness. But this movie is really, really well done, incredibly stylistic. The sequence in Dracula's castle is, I would say, my favorite Dracula's castle sequence, and I've seen a fair number of these Dracula / Nosferatu adaptations. I think Coppola's is my favorite. It is so fun to see what he does with shadows here. It's so neat to see all of the things. It is way over the top, but I think that works. And again, it is very committed to this idea that the worst part about being Dracula is that you've been Dracula for centuries, is that you've been miserable and sad and alone for a really, really long time, and no one is ever going to help you. I think it's really well done. The other actors are doing a better job with their accents. Gary Oldman is a really great Dracula. And, yeah, I think if you enjoyed this movie for its adherence to kind of classic vampire lore, I think this version of Dracula would be a really fun watch for you.
Huh. Well, I have not seen that, but that was a pretty convincing recommendation.
Thank you.
But in the end, wherever you go, be it high or be it low, we all know... And there is no ointment for life's difficulty and its many disappointments.
Wow. Thank you, Dr. Seuss, for your closing
line.
You're
so welcome. I came up with that while I was listening to your recommendation.
Oh, great. Good job. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to this episode. Did you see Sinners? Do you think one of us missed something? Do you want to just send an angry email about Elliot's opinion? Send us
or Nathan's.
Yeah, or mine, I guess. I'm with the majority, though, so no one's going to do that, bro.
And again, we should say again, go and see this movie. Get out there and get it watched. Come up with your own conclusion.
I definitely think it's a movie. I'd be very surprised if someone went to this movie and didn't come away with any opinion. I feel like the movie is original enough and creative enough that even if you disliked it like Elliot, I think you would still you would strongly feel that dislike. It is not a movie that you watch and you're like, yeah, it was kind of meh, it was kind of whatever. That vampire Irish jig sequence was kind of like ho-hum, so trite. No, there's no other movie with a vampire Irish jig sequence.
I didn't dislike it. I gave it a C+. That's a positive grade.
Anyway, send us an email. Be sure to check out the blog. And be sure to check us out next week. We're going to have another brand new episode. We'll do another super fun review. So be sure to check that out. And we hope you have a great week in between.